Okay, hello, it's Lisa Thompson again. Good afternoon. Thank you for attending the webinar today. I'm the program coordinator in the Center for Local Health for Finance, and I'd like to welcome you to our third Local Health Department Leadership Lunch and Learn Orientation webinar. I mentioned a few minutes ago, but in case you're just now joining us, if you would, please be sure that your phone's on mute. And do not place your phone on hold during the webinar. This way, all the participants can hear the presentation. We did have some folks that had trouble joining live meetings. I did email out the PowerPoint presentation to everyone. So if you're unable to join live meeting, you can at least follow along. And Brad is going to, when he does his presentation, he'll periodically tell you what page number we're on. To be responsive and thorough in answering questions, we will have time at the conclusion of the presentation for those. Those questions that we're not able to answer or require more input from the Bureau subject matter experts will be compiled, and we can address those in an FAQ to be released after the webinar, or we can incorporate that into another Lunch and Learn webinar. If you have any questions during the presentation, please send those to our Center for Local Health email inbox. If you don't have that address, it is dhhrbphclh@wv.gov. An evaluation will be sent at the conclusion of the webinar, and we're going to use your feedback to improve and develop additional training resources, and we will post those on the Center for Local Health website. Okay, here to present today's webinar on environmental health program is Brad Cochran, the Director for the Office of Environmental Health Services, Public Health Sanitation Division. Brad is a graduate of Fairmont State College with a BA degree in education. He began his public health career in 1991 as a sanitarian at the Marion County Health Department. There he worked for 11 and a half years. July 1, 2002, he was hired as a district sanitarian in the Beckley District Office of Environmental Health Services, Public Health Sanitation Division. December 1st, he became the General Sanitation Program Manager for the Public Health Sanitation Division and the main office in Charleston. He also supervised six district sanitarians located throughout West Virginia. On November 1st, 2006, he became the Interim Director for the Public Health Sanitation Division. And on March 15, 2007, he was named the Director of the Public Health Sanitation Division. And with that, Brad, I'll turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you, Lisa. Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone for participating today. Thank you for taking time out of your... Looks like we got some background noise.
Yeah. Folks, if you wouldn't mind to put your phone on mute, we're getting some background noise. That way everyone can hear the presentation. We would appreciate it. Thank you.
Again, thanks again for participating in this webinar today. Hopefully we won't take up too much of your time as we go through the environmental health programs. Environmental health, in my mind, affects more people than anybody in the state regarding to any public health program in the state of West Virginia. I truly believe that. And I think as we go through this webinar today, you'll understand of the different types of programs and things that we look at on how many people we do affect within this state. Before getting into the environmental health programs from the local health perspective, I feel that it's important that you guys get to know a little bit about the Office of Environmental Health Services, which is whom I work for. There are currently three divisions within the Office of Environmental Health Services: Environmental Engineering, Radiation Toxics and Indoor Air, and the Public Health Sanitation Division, which is a division that I oversee. That division is the one who has the most routine contact with local health departments. We also have an additional unit, which is our administrative services. Readiness coordinator sets in that role as well. So those of you who are also do TP work should be aware of our readiness coordinator as well. I'm going to touch base a little bit about all three of the divisions before we get into the local health perspectives. The Environmental Engineering Division, their primary responsibility is public water systems. And within that division, there are five different programs that have some responsibility with that as well. The Compliance Enforcement Program determines whether or not a public water system is in compliance with all state rules and federal regulations pertaining to the Safe Drinking Water Act. There is some local health participation and involvement when we have to deal with compliance and enforcement of public water systems. And those are the systems that are the small systems that are on their own individual well that are classified as a public water system, such as a restaurant or a campground. Periodically, there are letters that are sent out to the sanitarians within those counties if there is an issue with their compliance requirements as a public water system. And we've asked sanitarians and local health departments to suspend permits for those facilities whenever that occurs. And that program has worked very well. It has brought those systems into compliance. So we really appreciate your help in that involvement. The data management program, basically what it says. They enter all the data that's received from all the public water systems throughout the state that's required. There's bacteriological reports, monthly operational reports, chemical reports, and a lot of other things as well. They enter those into a database called the SIDWIS database, which is the Safe Drinking Water Information Systems that's operated by the EPA. Training and certification, they certify any of the public water system operators. They also certify well drillers, pump installers, backflow assembly testers, monitoring well certifiers, and wastewater operators. The Infrastructure and Capacity Development Program does a couple different things. One of their programs is to issue funds provided by the EPA for various types of infrastructure projects under the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and the Drinking Water Treatment Revolving Fund. The Capacity and Development Program helps the drinking water systems to improve their finances, management infrastructure, and operations so they can provide safe drinking water consistently, reliably, and cost-effectively. So they do a lot of work in the field with those folks. The Plan Review and Permitting section within Infrastructure and Capacity Development, they review all the proposed plans for public water systems. They also review plans for recreational water facilities, dairy farm waste disposal facilities, water vending machines, and those are vending machines that you see in places like Walmart where you actually take a jug in and fill it up, and sewage collection and treatment facilities to make sure that they comply with all the required design standards that are out there for those. The Source Water Protection Plan is under the Safe Drinking Water Act. It requires states to develop and implement a source water assessment and protection called SWAP program to design to evaluate the vulnerability of public drinking water systems and possible sources of contamination. There is some local involvement in this now with the new legislation that passed related to the chemical spill a couple years ago. Public systems are now required to come up with protection plans, and they have to have some public meetings and some input from local folks. At that point in time, local health departments may be asked to participate in those public meetings as well as also participate in the planning of the development of the plan. Don't know if that's happening too much at this point, but local health departments can be involved per the legislation. Move on to the next slide. The Radiation, Toxics, and Indoor Air Division is the second division within our office. They basically have six different programs there as well. Asbestos compliance, certification and licensing, childhood lead poisoning prevention, indoor air, radiological health, and clandestine drug laboratory remediation. The asbestos compliance basically is what it is. They do all the compliance for asbestos-related issues within the state of West Virginia. Abatement projects, inspections of those type of products. They also conduct asbestos licensing inspections, also provide technical assistance and education and outreach on asbestos-related issues. Certification and licensing, they certify, license, and do the auditing of the asbestos, lead, and radon training providers, as well as issuing licenses to asbestos, lead, and radon professionals and contractors. Under the childhood lead prevention program, our lead program conducts environmental health lead assessments related to children's elevated blood lead levels. That blood lead level is now down to 5 grams per deciliter. Anytime that occurs, our office is notified that there is a situation to where a child has an elevated blood lead level, and we have people that go out and conduct environmental inspections of those facilities. They also conduct lead licensing inspections as well to make sure that the licensed people are properly doing what they're supposed to do. One thing that related to local health departments that the lead program is involved with is child care centers. All child care centers that are required to have a risk lead assessment performed at the facility is built prior to 1978. So when our staff goes around to do that, they send a letter to the local health department letting them know that that child care center is either does not require a lead assessment or that one needs to be required and what those results would be. The indoor air program, we have very minimal responsibility here, even though it is a program that they are required to do to some degree. We basically investigate indoor air quality complaints at the request of the governor, the secretary, or the commissioner, and that's usually related to public buildings only. Rad Health, they basically respond to all radiation accidents in the state of West Virginia. They also register and inspect all facilities where radiation machines are used in West Virginia, and they do a lot of outreach and public education as well. The last one, the Clandestine Drug Laboratory Remediation Program, they conduct assessments when there is an issue found with a potential meth lab. They also will site properties and deem those properties unlivable or unoccupable until such time that they've been properly abated. We do have some local health assistance involvement with those, and that's when a meth lab is found in a permitted facility that the local health department has jurisdiction under. Normally, routinely occurs in hotels and motels, and we've also had some occur in schools. We'll now move on to the Public Health Sanitation Division. Again, my division, which is the one that has the most support of the local health departments. We have a mission, and our mission basically is to develop a statewide program to make sure that we can make sure that our state as a whole is safe from general environmental factors or whatever the case may be. And we cannot achieve this mission without the support from local health departments. So you're very, very important in what we do from the Public Health Sanitation Division. With our mission, we have goals. Our goals, obviously, is to provide a safe food and milk supply for the state. We also think it's important that we control infectious medical waste through proper handling, treatment, and disposal. And we also want to control the general environmental factors that we have the ability to control through rule and regulation. We also sometimes, when needed, will assist with public health assessments, investigations, and studies. Continuing with our goals, we also, to make sure that we can do what we need to do and do it correctly, we want to ensure that we have a well-trained staff of professional sanitarians throughout the state. We want to promote quality and effective environmental health programs at the local health level. So when we do that, we have to be sure that we're doing the right things here on our side. One thing that we're constantly striving for is consistency throughout the state, and we start hearing this more and more every year, especially around the legislative session time. We want to be consistent in the interpretations that we provide to local health departments. We also want to make sure that local health departments are consistently doing the inspections and conducting inspections and following the rules as they are written and need to be enforced. And we do have some issues with that. I think it's getting better and has gotten better over the years. But again, we do hear consistency issues throughout as we go and talk to folks at the legislature. We're now up to slide 8. The Public Health Sanitation Division, as you can see, our staff is not too big. We have 22 staff members. We're fully staffed statewide. We have folks here located in our central office here in Charleston, as well as our district offices throughout the state. As you can see, there's a variety of folks that do different things in those district offices. The next slide is a map of of our districts. This map shows the counties and who the district sanitarian has been assigned to those particular counties. Hopefully most of you, the administrators there, I know the sanitarians do, but hopefully the administrators are aware of who their district sanitarian is within their respective counties. You also see the locations on the map of where our offices are located. Again, we have 5 district offices throughout the state, And like I say, counties are assigned to specific sanitarians in those areas. Our program staff, as you can see, we have program staff within our office. Looks like 2, 4, 6, 8, 8 or 9 of us there. Our assistant director is also down here, as well as all the program managers that from the different programs within the state that we oversee. Briefly go through each of the programs a little bit, just very minutely on what they do. Our milk program, obviously, basically is pretty much handled through the Office of Environmental Health Services. We do inspections of producer dairy farms, pasteurization plants. We conduct raw milk pasteurized samples at these facilities. We inspect and regulate the bulk milk haulers that haul their milk from the farm to the plants. And we also inspect the cheese producers that are producing and manufacturing cheese in the state of West Virginia. The last bullet there is local health departments. They do collect finished product milk samples. Not every health department does that, and it's not a mandated program. However, for us to allow our milk to ship, finished milk to ship interstate, we have to have milk samples, and the only way we can really rely on that is through local health support. We currently have about 15 health departments that are currently involved in this program. Again, it's not a mandated program. At one point in time, when I was in the county, I think just about every county conducted milk samples back then. But again, we've had a number of producers and suppliers either merge or go out of business or no longer serve West Virginia. So therefore, we don't need every county to have involvement with those. But we do need local health support in collecting some finished product milk samples throughout the state and submit them to the lab for testing. The bottled water program, again, is a statewide operated program that's run by the Office of Environmental Health Services. We issue permits and conduct inspection at the West Virginia bottling plants and distributors, and we also permit all the out-of-state distributors. Probably 90% of the bottled water that's sold in West Virginia comes from out of state, so therefore we do regulate the distributors who distribute their water into West Virginia. We do have some local health assistance involvement with when we have a bottled water issue. A lot of times we'll call a local health department if there's been a recall issued on bottled water to see that that bottled water has been removed from the shelves in the stores. Periodically, we have that happen, not too often, but we do rely on local health departments to go to their retail facilities and to check those for us. Again, we only have a one or two person bottled water program in the state, so therefore we have to rely on local health support for some of these things. Infectious medical waste program, those are involved with small and large quantity generators. We issue permits for those who are considered a large quantity generator. A large quantity generator is someone who routinely produces more than 50 pounds of infectious medical waste in a one-month period. We also inspect commercial treatment facilities. We have one of those in West Virginia right now. We do some operator training and certification where needed. And we also do some alternative treatment review and approval if we get a request for some alternative treatment to be allowed in West Virginia. Again, we use local health assistance periodically in this program as well. If we have someone find some medical waste in what they perceive to be medical waste in a location, a lot of times we'll contact the local health department, or you may get contacted first and be aware of it before we are, to determine what that may be, and we may ask you to visit the site and see what it is and see whether or not we need to get somebody out there from our office. We only have one infectious medical waste inspector for the entire state, and she stays relatively busy. But we do thank the local health departments for assisting us in matters like those when we need them, and we have used them on occasion in the past. The general sanitation program, probably when you look at it, is probably one of the larger programs that we have within our office. As you can see, it covers a variety of types of facilities here. And as we get further into what local health involvement is with these programs, I'll kind of give you more background on each one of these a little bit. This program encompasses basically 6 different rules within the environmental health system, as well as part of the West Virginia Code. I don't know what happened there. Sorry about that. I don't know how that got up there. Now on slide 13, our on-site wastewater program, it's related to, obviously, on-site disposal systems. We do issue some permits out of this office related to surface discharge systems and some relatively large subsurface systems. We conduct on-site evaluations and provide technical assistance to local health departments whenever we need to do that. We certify all the licensed sewage and system installers in West Virginia. We also offer some training courses and study materials. We're involved in sanitarian training with those, as well as offering licensed training for Class II installers. We also oversee the Sewage Advisory Board, which is a group of individuals that are set up through the sewage systems rule. It allows folks from industry and regulatory folks and citizens to participate on that board. We do have local health representation on that board. I think there are at least three sanitarians, I believe, on the board at this point in time. And they basically suggest changes to the sewage rules and regulations. They also will review any new technologies that are considered to be coming into West Virginia for approval and handle other sewage issues as needed. Sanitarian training program, obviously, it's required by West Virginia Code. We want to make sure that we have a well-trained staff to go out and conduct the environmental programs within the state. The program, again, is required by West Virginia Code. It's a class that has to be completed within 1 year of the hire date. It involves 8 weeks of classroom training and 1 week of what we call on-the-job training, normally in food. It is not 8 continual weeks. I think we probably have maybe a few folks on board today that may have participated in sanitarian training in their careers. We conduct it annually. We've kind of moved it around a little bit. I think fall and the winter seems to work best for everybody at this point. We tried to move the course a little bit between two locations, Charleston and Morgantown. One of the weeks in Charleston is now held up at Cedar Lakes, where we have our on-site sewage demonstration projects up there. We use a variety of different types of folks to speak to this course, including sanitarians, engineers, and others within different offices and agencies. And we do use some local health sanitarians who have some pretty good presentations to provide related to things on handling complaints and those types of things that we utilize as well.
9:30. 9:30? Yeah.
The food program basically covers all aspects of food within the state, including retail food establishments, and we'll get a little bit into those again. Those are really what local health departments deal with for the most part. The food manufacturing facilities, those are facilities that are usually regulated by the Office of Environmental Health Services. There could be an instance where a local health department would be issuing a permit on the behalf of while they might be considered a manufacturer, they are considered a retail establishment or a food establishment under some certain circumstances if they're only selling directly to the consumer and not wholesaling to somebody else. Also depends on what type of product that they're going to be doing that with and whether or not it falls under state or local jurisdiction. Farmers markets is basically a new and evolving program in itself due to legislation that passed, and we'll get into that a little bit further as we move along as well. I do want to emphasize that through all the programs that we deal with on the state side, we do try to provide technical assistance and rules interpretations for any of our programs to the local health departments on a routine basis. That's something that we do get a lot of calls, and we want you to keep calling if you're really not sure about something on that aspect. Sanitarians are do a pretty good job of calling us whenever they feel that they need some clarification on something, and we want them to continue to do that. Now we're going to get into what the meat of this presentation was to be about, local health departments' role in environmental health programs. As you can see, it is one of the basic public health services, for those of you that we are on slide 16 at this point. And it's the authorities derived from West Virginia Code 16211, which is the part of the West Virginia Code that relates to local boards of health. There are many legislative rules and parts of statute that will fall under environmental health jurisdiction from the local level. A lot of rules that will we actually put the jurisdiction back to the local health to assure that they are those folks are meeting compliance. So what we're going to do now is briefly go through the programs from the local health perspective. We'll start out with the general sanitation program. Like I mentioned earlier, that's a very large program within the state. There's a legislative rule that was promulgated several years ago to cover a variety of things and bring them all into one rule. That's Legislative Rule 64 CSR 18. It does require the issuance of operational permits. If you remember the slide 12 that we briefly went back over before, there were a lot of different types of programs that were listed there. Recreational facilities, those include campgrounds, parks, organized camps, those types of facilities. Schools include both private and public schools. The institutions, public and private correctional facilities, for the most part, since most of the private and public correctional facilities in the state are now state-operated, those are handled normally by our staff. I think there's only one correctional facility in the state of West Virginia that's still under local jurisdiction at this point. Lodging facilities include hotels, motels, bed and breakfast inns, tourist cabins, and labor camps. And a labor camp is basically related to 10 or more people that work that are staying in an area to where they're working for labor, such as over in the Eastern Panhandle where they used to work in the apple orchards. We don't see too many of those anymore, but they are still out there. We talked about mass gatherings was mentioned under the general sanitation rule. Mass gathering, it basically is the event. It's defined as for more than 250 people at a particular event. It does not include assembly in a permanent structure designed, equipped, and intended for use by large numbers of people, such as stadiums or auditoriums. Basically, what you're looking for when you issue a permit for a mass gathering is you're looking for to make sure that the facility, for whatever the size, capacity, or what they're are looking for crowd-wise, they have adequate trash receptacles and pickup, adequate restroom facilities. There is a formula in the rule that talks about the number of facilities that are needed in porta-johns and those types of things based on the number of people they're expecting. There could be on-site parking that needs to be taking place on this event as well, and in some instances, overnight camping. So there are criteria involved in the rule that when you issue a permit for those, that those things have to be followed. Care facilities that were mentioned back on slide 12 include such things as adult daycare facilities, residential care facilities, non-disaster shelters such as homeless shelters and domestic violence shelters, as well as some drug rehab facilities. And that's as long as these facilities are not licensed by the Office of Health Facilities Licensure and Certification, commonly known as OFLAC. Again, we talk about annual inspections needing to be conducted in these facilities. Again, it doesn't apply to colleges and universities or public restrooms. They are handled on a complaint basis only as far as an inspection goes. School inspections, however, are only required public and private schools once every 2 years. Those are the only inspections that are required, not to be required at least annually. Child care centers. A child care center is defined as a non-residential facility that has seven or more children for any or all part of the day. And there are a variety of what we consider a child care center. They include what we call daycare centers, family daycare centers, some types of nursery schools and preschools. There are some exemptions within the rule that do not fit the definition of a child care center. So you just have to be cognizant of those whenever you're going to determine what you need to permit those facilities. Also, DHHR licensing has some involvement with certain types of child care centers, where, again, they may issue a license based on the permit that's issued by the local health department. When we talk about the seven or more for any or all part of the day, an example of that may be some of these churches have these 3 or 4 hour type of nursery schools or preschools where they're in there maybe for 3 hours in the morning and then another group comes in the afternoon. If they have a total of seven or more total, which is they could have four in the morning and three in the afternoon, that meets the definition of a child care center as far as our regulation is concerned. Again, you have to issue an operational permit for those, and they require an inspection once every 6 months.
Hey, folks, I wanted to remind you one more time, if you don't mind, to mute your phones. We're still getting some background noise, and we want to make sure everybody can hear the presentation. Thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you, Lisa. As we move on to slide 19, recreational water facilities, this basically used to be our swimming pools and bathing beaches when I first started as a sanitarian, but over the years it has evolved into a variety of different types of facilities, including water slides, lazy rivers, splash parks, wave pools, spas, hot tubs, you name it. If it's got water attached to it and it's got some type of a basin for water, it's probably going to be considered a recreational water facility. And these are facilities that are operated by a variety of entities, including municipalities. Could be a park, could be a hotel, apartment complex, a school, some type of a club or institution. A lot of types of the pools and recreational facilities are out there. It does not include private residential pools as defined in the rule. Again, there's an operational permit that has to be issued for those that fall under Legislative Rule 64 CSR 16. Requires an inspection of not less than 2 times per year or per season, depending on whether or not that facility is a year-round facility or just a seasonal facility. Water samples are required to be taken during those inspections. We also have some policy procedures in play through our Environmental Health Procedures Manual that requires not only the sampling within 30 days of opening for a recreational water facility, and then once more during the operational season. Those samples include, obviously, if they have a shallow and a deep section, you want to collect samples at those two sections of the facility, as well if they have a separate wading pool or a separate slide, if applicable for those types of situations. Also under that policy procedure, we have we want health departments to go back and do what we call biweekly checks. It's not a complete inspection of the facility where they should be going back and doing biweekly chlorine, pH, and water clarity checks. I know when I was a sanitarian, there were multiple times that when we went out to do those that we would find the chlorine levels or the pH levels being way out of kilter and have to temporarily shut down the pool until they could get back into compliance. Now, this biweekly check does not apply to bathing beaches, obviously, because we're using natural waters for those, and they really don't have anything to worry about there. Also, recreational water facilities are required to submit weekly operational reports to the local health departments, and they should be doing that on a routine basis as well. Body piercing and tattoo studios. West Virginia Code 1637 and Legislative Rule 64 CSR 80 deals with body piercing. West Virginia Code 1638 is the statute on tattoo studios in West Virginia. They all require an operational permit. They require an annual inspection. And body piercing technicians have to be licensed by the Office of Environmental Health Services. So when sanitarians go out to a body piercing facility, everybody there should have a current certificate that's been issued by our health department or by our staff. So when local health departments go in to do body piercing inspections, they can assure that the technicians are certified through the state. There are no requirements, however, for tattoo studio artists at this point in time. The statute's not been changed since its inception back in the 90s. We do have some policy procedures that relate to body piercing and tattoo studios as well, basically because the industry has changed since we first got involved with it in the 90s. At some point in time, we hope to incorporate those into rule revisions and statute changes as well. Continuing to move forward now on slide 21, manufactured home communities. That's formerly known as our mobile home parks rule. Back when that rule was revised, the industry asked that we kind of get away from calling them a mobile home and go into a manufactured home. So therefore, we did that when we did the rule revision. A manufactured home community is defined as a an area, tract, or parcel of land upon which four or more manufactured homes used or occupied for dwelling purposes are parked either free or for monetary consideration, and the tract of land could include any roadway, building, structure intended for use as part of the manufactured home community. The old rule, when they were considered mobile home parks, only required two or more to be there as to be considered a mobile home park. We actually changed that again to the rule revision to four due to the fact that we had a lot of facilities where mobile homes were often had two or three on the same tract of land where it was family owned, and they were just for having family members living there. So we kind of got away from that and decided we should move it up to four when we did the rule change back in, I think it was 2010 or 11. There are construction permit authority for manufactured home communities, and depending on whether or not how many lots there are, whether or not it's public water or sewer, determines whether or not that construction permit is issued either on the local level or the state level, and there's a policy procedure relating to that as well. I will later on in the presentation show you a snapshot of our website to show how you can locate these on our website as well. On-site wastewater, two legislative rules regarding on-site wastewater, 64 CSR 9, which is the sewage systems rule, and 64 CSR 47, which is the design standards. 64 CSR 9 is where the construction permits are required. Final inspections of the system are required before the system can be covered up. It's where also the issuance of septic tank cleaners that are out there that are permitted by local health departments fall under that particular rule. And one thing that we've had some issue with is that the septic tank cleaning permit is a statewide permit, not an individual county-issued permit by the local health department. Therefore, that means once they've got a septic tank cleaning permit in X county, that permit is valid statewide. If we also have some out-of-state cleaners that come into West Virginia to pump, usually those are located near the state county lines where they come across the borders, and usually those permits are issued by their county where they usually come into the state or where they do most of their business. But the permit is issued on the local level from the county operated ones in West Virginia, normally from the county where that business is located, and then that allows them to use that permit to permit statewide. Okay, now we get into the food program. More than likely, the food program is the largest program that local health departments have to deal with, and most of what you deal with on the local level is our restaurants, grocery stores, delis, mobile food operations, vending machines that offer what we can call potentially hazardous foods, temporary food facilities, which are facilities that operate less than 2 weeks at a fixed location for a given time, school cafeterias, bars, and taverns. Again, this has been delegated to the local health departments, and this is, again, probably the largest program that you all have. The legislative rule 64 CSR 17 is the rule for food establishments. It currently has adopted the 2005 FDA food code. It requires operational permits and requires an inspection every 6 months. You see an asterisk by the slide there on the inspection of every 6 months. Unless a county is doing what we consider risk-based inspections per the food code, and a risk-based inspection is an inspection that's done based on the type of population served in the menu, you can set up your program to do those either inspect them up to 1 to 4 times per year, again, based on what the criteria is within the food code. Either you're doing risk-based inspections or you're not. There's really no in-between on those as far as the number of inspections that are required. It's either two per year or you're doing risk-based inspections based on what the criteria of the code calls for. Legislative Rule 64 CSR 102 is a new rule which has currently gone through the legislative process this year. That's related to the farmers market vendors. due to legislative changes at the request of the Farmers Market Association, there is now a rule in place for particular foods that require a uniform, what they call a uniform farmers market vendor permit. That legislation just passed again this past year. It went into effect actually in June of 2015. However, again, the rule has not been promulgated yet, so we've had to develop a policy procedure, which is procedure F-16, which determines what products need a permit from the local health departments, which do not require a permit, that require local health registration, and some of those products that don't require any permit or registration at all. This rule will also, and legislation that was passed, allows for a statewide permit or a local permit, depending on what type of permit they pay for. There's a permit fee of $15, I believe, for a local permit, and if the vendor wants to sell his or her product in multiple counties, then they can obtain a statewide permit in the county where they obtain their initial permit and pay an additional fee to do that. And I think that statewide fee is a fee of $25. Something that's relatively new, but it is in effect right now. Individual water supplies, those are wells for home use where there's not public water available. There are two rules that apply to those, 64 CSR 19, which is where you issue the permits to drill, construct, alter, or abandon a well. That rule also requires a completion report from the driller be submitted to the local health department within 30 days. Also requires well driller and pump installer certification requirements. Legislative Rule 64 CSR 46 obviously is the design standards for construction and abandonment of wells, and what the proper installation is for pump installation. The design standards do not apply to water wells that are used for public drinking water systems. They have their own set of design standards if it's going to be considered a public drinking water system. Slide 25, we get into some other programs that you see on the local level. Obviously, I think most counties have a clean indoor air regulation at this point, and you deal with those based on what your particular regulation is. This is not a statewide regulation, as you all know. So however you particularly deal with your particular county ordinance is up to whatever each health department does. I do know that there are some grant monies or some funding available for inspections that you do through the tobacco program. If you're interested in getting involved in those and receiving some money for conducting clean indoor air inspections, you need to contact Christina Mickey with the Clean Indoor Air Initiative to do that. Animal encounters, obviously, Environmental Health is involved in animal encounters on a routine basis. There's a policy procedure that was developed and revised several years ago that's on the procedures policy page as well. It's called DC4 Rabies Control Guide. It has all the specific requirements for the different agencies, including local health responsibilities, to deal with animal encounters. Investigations of nuisance complaints is probably one that is a large amount of the sanitarian's time as well. A lot of these complaints that come in are sometimes neighborhood squabbles or neighbor squabbles, but they do need to be investigated as you get those complaints. We have some policy procedures relating to complaints as well, on whether or not they are a FOIable issuance or how you should handle those types of situations as well. I mentioned tanning facilities for one reason. I think 2 years ago the legislature passed some very minimal guidelines for tanning facilities in West Virginia. And the statute in West Virginia Code 1645 gives the local health departments the authority to enter those facilities and to determine whether or not the facility is in compliance with what's in the West Virginia Code. These inspections are not to be done on basis related to the sanitation practices that are going on in the facility. It's only related to what the law currently allows, and the law basically is, again, very vague. It requires some disclosures about the harmful potential for using a tanning facility. They have to have some FDA warnings posted people that want to tan and that are under the age of 18 have to have a consent form that's on site and signed and dated and verified by valid photo ID with parental consent as well, and the parental consent has to be in person and signed for as well. Anybody between the ages of 14 and 18 must have that form on site at the facility. And those forms are good for a one-year period, and they have to be renewed if the person wants to come back again. They also, no one under the age of 14 is permitted to be to utilize a tanning facility. So if a health department gets a complaint, they can go in and inspect one of these based on those types of requirements. And should they be in violation, you can go through magistrate court and have that facility fined. But, again, it doesn't relate to sanitation practices that go on in the tanning facility. This is the snapshot on slide 27 of our Public Health Sanitation Division webpage. We also have an intranet site as well, where there are some things on there that forms and applications that we don't want to get out to the public. This is only for local health and state use. But this is our basic internet site. You can get to all of the variety of programs by clicking on the different links to the left. Going down the page on the left-hand side, under other items, the top link says Environmental Health Procedures Manual. That is where you can find any policy procedure that we have in play as it relates to any program that we deal with from the environmental side. And they are basically categorized based under program. So if there's, you know, we referred to several of those policy procedures throughout the discussion here. You know, if you have any questions or concerns about those procedures, you know where to look them up as you go to review those. We'll talk a few minutes about fees for permits. West Virginia Code 16211, that gives local health the authority to charge permit fees. There's a legislative rule related to the permit fees that can be charged by a local health department. 64 CSR 30. It does set the maximum allowable amounts within the rule. There are prorated fees based on the issuance and expiration dates of a permit, and I really want to stress that because we do hear that periodically at the legislature that some health departments aren't prorating fees, but you're required to prorate a fee based on when that permit was issued within the annual yearly permit that it is. And that fee schedule is in the rule. The way the rule was written when it was revised in 06 allowed for a 25% maximum allowable increase per year from what you currently charge. Also allows for a late fee for folks who are more than 10 days late. If your Board of Health has adopted that, you can charge a late fee as well. To help offset some of the cost of the permit fees not coming in on time. There also obviously is an approval process which you have to go through in order to increase your fees. Most of you probably know what that is, but I'll briefly just tell you what the steps are. You obviously have to have Board of Health approval. It must be reflected in your Board of Health minutes. You then must have a public notification with the 30-day comment period that you're going to either start implementing permit fees or increase the current permit fees that you have. Once that comment period is ended, if you have any comments, you have to respond to those comments as well. You then submit that packet of information down to the Center for Local Health. We also have a checklist of documents that need to be submitted that we can provide upon request. Or if you have assistance related to environmental fees, you can contact me directly. I speak routinely with administrators who are thinking about increasing fees and what they can and can't do, and I'm more than happy to help you guys get through the process as you need to do that. But once you've submitted that information down, then it'll be reviewed. Normally by me if it's an environmental fee. If I approve it, don't have any concerns with it, or if I do have concerns, I'm going to contact you and ask you what we have here or whatever. But once we get the approval, I submit that back to the Center for Local Health, and then the commissioner will sign off on a letter and send that back to you. And one of the last things that has to occur, according to the rule, is that once the approved fee schedule has been approved and you've got the approval to start implementing those fees, you are required to submit a copy of your fee schedule with the clerk of the county commission or municipality of which the board is a part. I think that's happened for the most part, but there's been instances where I know that that has not happened. But I just want to make you aware that that is within the rule and is your requirement that you do, anytime you raise a fee, that you you do submit a new copy. Or if it's a combined Board of Health to all the different counties, commissions, and municipalities that those affect. Right now, we currently have 24 local health departments that are at maximum levels. We have an additional 12 health departments that are very close to those maximums, maybe maximum on some but not quite on all the others due to the 25% increase the way the legislature revised the last rule. This rule covers all the environmental health permit fees with the exception of body piercing and tattoo studios, which are in their current rule or statute, and the septic tank cleaning trucks, which is in the sewage systems rule, and the farmers market vendors, which is going to be in its new rule and also within Chapter 16 of the code. One thing that I do want to stress is that even though those permit fees are not a part of the permit fee rule, we want to stress that all permits, if they're issued sometime during the course of the year where they need to be prorated, that they be prorated for all permits. That question came up at the rulemaking review committee this year with the farmers market vendor rule. They wanted to change the dates that were proposed as when that expiration of that permit and issuance would occur. And one of the questions that came up was when to issue those. And what we stressed so that we didn't have to change that date at the request of local health departments. We left it where they wanted it at. In order to stop the legislature from making a suggested change to that, I indicated that prorating of fees would be is what occurs if a vendor comes on board, after the season has started, say a few months after the season has started, so they're not paying for a yearly permit. So, again, we stress that prorating of permit fees for all permits that are issued for operational permits be followed under that prorating system. Matter of fact, when we issue permits from our office that are operational permits, we follow the same prorated scale, even though we are not required to by our rules. Environmental health fees for service is another way to supplement some of the costs related to environmental programs. Again, the authority to allow you to do that is within West Virginia Code 16211B6. There's a specific legislative rule related to fees for service. And Section 9.3 is the main section that determines how a local Board of Health can set those types of fees. I won't read that particular slide to you. Again, we're on slide 28 on what you can do. There is an approval process for fees for service as well. It's very similar to what was mentioned in the fees for permit rule. This is a list of common environmental health fees for services that we see. Those include obviously food worker training, seeing duplicate permits, water samples, loan valuations. Those are for septics and wells where your health department still may be involved in going out when a lending institution is going to allow a refinance or the purchase of a home. If it's on a well or a septic or both, they want an evaluation of those systems prior to the loan being approved. Some health departments are involved in those, some are not. It's not a mandated program. But if you are, those are some of the things that you can charge a fee for. Reinspection fees is becoming more and more common. If you have a facility where you have to go out and do an inspection over and above the required inspections, to help recoup fees for your time involved. You can charge a reinspection fee. Plan review fees or something else that's picking up. A lot of times health departments will be reviewing plans for a new restaurant or a new hotel motel or something of that nature. And those take some time in order to go through those in detail. And for the time being in the office and looking at those and reviewing those to see if the facility is going to be in compliance with what needs to occur, your folks can't be in the field, so therefore you can charge some fees for those as well. Homeowners' exams for septic and well and pump installation is becoming more and more common as the rules do allow homeowners to install their own septic system as long as they've passed an exam, and also to install their own pump on a well if they've also passed an exam. So health departments are taking advantage of that to allow folks to come in and take those exams as well. One thing I do want to mention in relationship to the food worker training up there on the food handlers cards, there was new legislation that passed just this past legislative session relating to allowing a statewide food handler's card be issued. Also, it allowed minimum guidelines be set for types of classes that can be taught. The key here is that while a local health department does not have to issue or offer online training, there are multiple counties that do, but if a in your county does not opt to do online trainings, then if another county does offer those and issues and they get a card that's valid statewide by paying the additional fee, your county has to accept that other county's online course if it's for a statewide card. Again, the local health department itself is not required to offer online training, but if you don't, and somebody else gets a statewide card in another county that's valid in statewide in the state of West Virginia, you have to honor that card. And we've had that come up, those questions come up just recently in a couple of different instances, so I just really wanted to clarify that as well. But again, if there are other fees that may be out there that you can charge a fee for service for, if it's one that we've not seen before, You can obviously contact me, and I'll ask for a legal opinion on whether or not it's a fee that will meet within the requirements of that particular rule. That pretty much wraps up my presentation. That's my contact information. Feel free to contact me at any given time that you need to. I don't mind taking calls from sanitarians, administrators, or whoever. Also, our staff can be contacted for any of the specific programs if you need to contact those folks as well. Their contact information is available on our website. I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to listen to this presentation today. Hopefully it gives you a better overview of what environmental health does, not only from the state side, but also on the local side. And if we have time, which I know we're almost out of time, if anybody has any questions, I would be more than welcome to answer them for you. Again, thank you for your participation in this program.
Okay, does anyone have any questions?
Okay. It's Mike Kilkenny from Cabell County.
Okay.
Can I get some clarification on when the local health jurisdiction begins on municipal water supply?
Municipal water supply, basically, obviously, if there's a public water issue, and I can probably get some better clarification for you on this from the public water folks itself, but just from what I'm thinking at this point in time is if there's an issue with a public water system, obviously you guys may be involved with boil water notices to some degree. Local health departments have the authority under the one of our policies to issue a boil water notice if the water system has not done so. That rarely happens. I don't know that it's ever happened to my knowledge on a big municipality type system. But most of the jurisdiction for local health in public water systems is going to be related to those that are on their own individual well that are considered a public water supply. I will ask our environmental engineering folks and our legal folks to get a more definite answer related to public water systems like the city systems and whatever. You may get notified of a complaint that are issues. If that's the case, what we normally have local health departments do is get the information and then contact one of our local district offices. All of our district offices also have engineering staff in those offices, and they will handle the system as it has a complaint related to it. But again, you're probably going to be the contact person initially, but more than likely you're really not going to have a lot of particular involvement.
Thank you. Hey, Brad, this is Bill Ayers up in Hardy County.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm good, sir. You?
Not bad.
I got a question. Environmental health indicators. Are they to start in January, being monitored, so on and so forth, or what's that process?
Well, Bill, at this point in time, I think, we were asked to provide indicators to you all related to how we can start tracking environmental programs within West Virginia. I don't think that's officially been finalized yet through the Bureau, with the Center of Local Health and at least talking to our folks. I don't have a definite on that yet because I really don't know. But I know there's been questions come up on it in the last week or so. I'll try to get that documented as fast as we can and get it out to you all.
Okay. And question, what's the average homeowner exam fee? Off the top of your head.
Which fee now?
If they want to take to install their own septic system?
We see them rating anywhere at this point in time from $10 to $25.
Okay. Thank you, Brad.
You're welcome, Bill. Have a good day.
You too.
Brad, this is Stephanie from Hampshire County. In health space, what parts are they required to be using at this point?
Stephanie, that's yet to be determined as well. Obviously,
okay.
I mean, we have an electronic reporting system that's out there. I think the Bureau is looking, I don't know what if the Bureau is looking to make that mandatory for everybody at this point. There's been discussion to that. Obviously, I think they want things reported electronically. It's easier to get that data that way. I think that's where it's leaning, but I don't have a definite answer on that yet as well.
Okay. Are there current reports that you're requiring monthly from sanitarians?
There is a policy procedure that's been out there for years called Policy Procedure A17, I think, maybe A16. I don't have that in front of me, but it requires a monthly report to be submitted. We brought that back up here just recently at one of our liaison committee meetings after some discussion arose on it from some Bureau folks, and on looking on how that we report. We're making some minor modifications to that report at this point in time. It may come down to where that needs to be submitted in some type of electronic format that's compatible to HealthSpace. I don't know that for sure yet. Again, those are still all being worked out. I will say that if you are utilizing HealthSpace, that report is basically automatically generated for you.
Okay.
Any other questions? If not, thanks again for your participation. Okay.